Good morning, everybody. So this morning is our last in the series of Shiurim on the Halachos of HaParashas Challah. The beauty of Torah is that as much as we think we have delved into the details of the Halachos and we know everything that there is possibly to know, the Torah, as we know, is Arucha Me'eretz Mida Urechava Mineyam. It is endless. There is so much. It is infinite. There is so much that we still have not yet discussed and will not have the opportunity to discuss, maybe at another point, but basically, I think we've gotten down most of the preliminary aspects of HaParashas Challah. And this morning's shiur, I just want to continue a little bit from last week. After the first half of the shiur, where we'll finish off some of the halachos, then I want to have the remainder of the shiur to review everything that we've learned the past 6 weeks, which is the second side of the sheet. I know nobody here needs any review, it's just for myself. So here, the smaller print, that's the review. The bigger print is the new material for today. So let's begin like this. We spoke last week about the amount of dough that is required in order to be obligated in performing a hafresha. We mentioned the uncertainty and the lack of precision that often is found when we talk about halachic measurements. And in general, we find that there's a lot of discrepancy, a lot of uncertainty when it comes to the sizes and the exact volumes of particular measurements. We mentioned last week why that is the case, because there was no mechanism of measuring with precision in the times of Chazal. And that's why nowadays we're left to a little bit of a question as to what the proper sizes are. Then we mentioned last week that in our contemporary terms, when it comes to HaFrashas Challah, the general assumption is that if you're baking something that is a volume of less than 3 pounds of flour, we assume that a HaFrasha is not required. If you're making something that is between 3 and 5 pounds of flour, then a HaFrasha should be done without reciting a bracha, because that's the questionable amount. And then a person is making 5 pounds or larger, we assume that a HaFrasha should be done with a bracha. Sounds pretty straightforward, sounds pretty simple. However, in today's shiur, the first half, what we're going to discuss is that we have a couple of cases where you need the dough with less than the required amount of HaFrasha, and yet somehow a obligation for HaFrasha creeps in later on. And the question is, how is that possible? How could it be that I use less than the required amount for HaFrasha, I make something with less than 3 pounds of flour, and yet somehow later on I'm able to be obligated in a hafrasha, even though at the time that I needed the dough, a hafrasha was not at all required? That's what we're going to discuss this morning. So there are three possibilities of how that can happen, and we're going to discuss each one individually. The first one is what the Mishnah calls neshicha. We'll talk about that in a minute. Nun, shin, yud, chav, hei. That's the first. The second one is what we call tziruf sal. And the third is what we call kisui ayude mapa. So these are three distinct mechanisms, three distinct scenarios that can come up in which a person would be obligated to do a hafrasha, even though at the time and at the process of kneading itself, there was no requirement of hafrasha at all. So as we mentioned, the first way that that can happen is through neshicha. Neshicha means as follows. Let's look at the Mishnah Meseches Challah. That's number Aleph on the source sheet. Ha'osa isaso kabin. If you have somebody who makes small amounts of dough, meaning I'm making a cookie recipe, doesn't have close to the amount of the required size. Or, for that matter, somebody mentioned to me last night at the shiur that nowadays we're spoiled and we have these fancy big mixers which have enough room in them to hold 5 pounds of flour. But apparently in the olden days, or not so olden days, they used to have mixers that were not able to hold so much flour. And the maximum amount of flour they could hold was 2.5 pounds, 2 pounds of flour, something of that nature. So what if a woman has a recipe that calls for 5 pounds of flour and she wants to do the hafresha, but her mixer only is able to hold 2 or 2.5 pounds of flour? So what will she do? She will make 2.5 pounds of flour now, put it on the counter, and then she will then mix once again 2.5 pounds of flour and put that on the counter. Now you have the two batches of flour sitting right next to one another on the counter and touching each other, says the Mishnah. If you have a case like that, ha'osa isaso kabin, you made your batter, you made your dough smaller than the required amount of hafrasha, for whatever reason, but that's what you did. Vinagu zebaze, and now they happen to be touching one another, says the Mishnah, peturim min hachala. They are not going to be obligated in challah just because they happen to be touching each other. Unless, ad sheyashochu, unless they stick, unless they paste, they cleave to one another, then we assume that a hafrasha is required. Now, the question is, how do you define sticking together? Right? There's a spectrum. How do you define what is considered sticking together? So the Taz there on Yerodeya, and this is the understanding of the Poskim, that basically the understanding should be that if they stick together to the point that if you tried to separate the two batches of dough, a little bit of each would come off, and it wouldn't be so simple just to separate them so evenly the way they were beforehand, that is called being really stuck together. So again, if I make one batch of dough, 2.5 pounds, put it on the counter, another batch of dough, 2.5 pounds, put it on the counter, and now they're not just touching each other, but they're touching to the point that if I try to separate the original batters, it wouldn't be so simple to do that, and a little bit of one would come off as I'm separating the other, then we assume that they are now joined together, and they combine to be obligated in a hafrasha. Again, even though at the time that the dough was kneaded, there was not the required amount of flour in there. But since later on they join together, that is enough to combine them to be obligated in a hafrasha schala. So that's with regard to that. The important halacha to know with regard to neshicha, with regard to this requirement of them being stuck together, is that this is only when you have a mixture which is min bimino, only when you have a mixture of two similar items. So if I made one batch of flour with wheat flour and one batch of dough with barley or oats flour or something else, those would not join together. It has to be that they were min bimino, they were the same kind of item that were used. Another important halacha to keep in mind with regard to this is that the Shulchan Aruch says this is only when ein makpidim ze al ze. So let's say, for example, ein makpidim ze al ze means I don't mind that they get stuck together. So let's say, for example, I know that I'm having a big Shalom Zachar in my house this Shabbos, and my oven, of course, happens to break. That's always when it happens. So I don't want to waste the day waiting for the repairman to come and fix the oven. I figure, may as well be productive, so I'm going to go ahead and mix all the batters that I want to use for later on once the oven is fixed. So I go ahead and I make one mixture of chocolate chip cookies, put those on the counter. Now I have another mixture of, I don't know, cinnamon buns. You put that on the counter. Now I have something else, mandel bread. So you have three different items, all using the same flour. I use the same flour for all three mixtures, but I certainly do not want all of those. Even if my cleaning lady comes and mistakenly puts all them together and now they're all stuck, which I would hope you would fire her if she would. But even if that happens, we would assume that that is not going to be considered obligated in a hafrasha. Why? Because even though they are stuck together to the point that you can no longer separate them easily, but that is something that you certainly do not want to be stuck together. These are two different recipes, they're two different items, it's two different things, or three different things, or four different things, and therefore, since these are very different, neshicha would not apply, even though they do get stuck together, but that would not be enough to obligate them in a hafrasha. Yeah. So that's a good question. Is that a hafrasha with a bracha, or a hafrasha without a bracha? I think my understanding is that when you have a neshicha, that is considered a hafrasha that would require a bracha. That's a real hafrasha schala. Again, that's as long as you meet the requirements of having two mixtures that are similar to one another that are using the same kind of flour. So that's with regard to neshicha. And again, we're trying to describe some scenarios of how you can have the kneading was done with less than the required amount for hafrasha, and yet somehow later along in the process, a hafrasha would be required. So that is the first way that this can happen. So far, so good. Any questions? Now let's move a little further. The second way that can happen is with something called tziruf sal. Tziruf sal means as follows. Let's look at number Beis on the source sheet, which is a Mishnah in Maseches Chala, Perek Beis. Says the Mishnah, Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Rabbi Eliezer describes the following scenario. Rabbi Eliezer says that it used to be, how did they bake bread? It used to be they had round ovens, but there were no racks in the ovens. So they used to take the sticky, pasty dough and stick it onto the side of the oven. After you thought it was done, you would take some sort of spatula, a metal instrument, and you would scrape it off the side of the oven. That was the way they baked the bread. That was the way they baked the dough. So the Mishnah writes over there, Rabbi Eliezer Amar av harodem enosin zal. If I go ahead, rodem means you scrape it off the side of the oven. So now my bread is finished, everything is complete, I scrape it off the side of the oven, and now I throw it into a big basket. Mitzar fan lechala. So you give a very practical example. I don't know if anyone has ever been to a matzah factory, a matzah bakery, but this is what happens, and this is what the Mishnah Berurah describes when trying to explain to us what this case is. So when you go to a matzah factory, they use very small quantities of dough when they make the matzahs. Why is that? Because they don't want it to become chametz. So if you're going to have more dough laying around that you cannot handle right away, there's a higher probability of that turning into chametz. So they make very small amounts at a time. Then they throw them into the oven after they're finished doing it, after they come out of the oven, they toss them, they're burning hot, so they toss them into this giant container. So they have hundreds and hundreds of matzahs that end up in this container. And then later on, someone comes and splits them up into the boxes that we get, that we buy, that we purchase in the store. So what happens? That's exactly the case of Tzirif Sal, which means at the time that you needed the dough, you had less than the required amount for a hafrasha. Again, because we're careful when making the matzahs to make smaller amounts, that it shouldn't get into a problem of chametz. Yet, when we take them out of the oven, we throw them into a basket, into a container, and in that container, we end up accumulating a lot more than the required amount for a hafrasha. We can have hundreds of matzahs in that big container. So in a case like that, Rabbi Lezer teaches us that a hafrasha would be required. And then the Gemara says also in Psachim, we're not going to read it inside, but the Gemara tells us the same story, that we paskin like Rabbi Lezer, that tzirif sal, that adding everything together, joining them together in a basket, is enough to obligate it and to require a hafrasha schala. So that's an important halacha to know. So there are some Rishonim that assume that the same way when we talked about neshicha, the same way when we spoke about two raw batches of dough getting stuck, they only required a hafrasha when you wanted them to be stuck together. But let's say, for example, I had cinnamon buns and chocolate chip cookies and something else, and now the raw batter gets stuck together. Those do not join to become obligated in a hafrasha. There were some who wanted to say that the same applies here. Same would apply here, that the only time a basket can actually join everything together is when I want that the items should be mixed, like the case of the matzahs. It doesn't bother me that the matzahs are mixed together. It makes a lot of sense. You're going to have them all in one big basket, and then you're going to separate them into the boxes. But say, for example, I'm making a Shalom Zachar, and I have hundreds of cookies coming out of the oven, and now I take all the chocolate chip cookies, put them in the basket, now I take the cinnamon buns that are done, put them in the basket. There are some who assume, well, you don't want those to be mixed together, you want them to be separate, even though now they happen to be cooling off in the same basket, but perhaps the din of tzirif sal should not apply. This is the opinion of some Rishonim, but it is not the accepted opinion. We are of the opinion that there's a difference between neshicha, between having two raw batches of dough that join together, where we say that only if your intention is for them to be joined, only then are you required to do a hafrasha. Whereas by tzirif sal, whereas by having everything put in one container, in one basket at the same time, we would assume that that would join together even if you do not have any intention for them to be together. So that is with regard to that. What kind of basket, what kind of container is required in order to have all the items joined together? So you take, for example, the Gemara discusses what we would call a flat sheet pan. If I have all of my cookies on a flat sheet pan and I happen to have a bunch of different items all together sitting on there cooling off, should I assume that now they can join together to be obligated in a hafrasha? Is that considered a container, a halachic container? So the Gemara says the following. Let's read the Gemara. The Gemara is in Psachim Mem Ches Amud Beis. This is number Dalet, the fourth entry on the source sheet. By Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah posed the following question. Tavla she'ein la livazbazin. When you have a flat sheet pan, which is just a fancy way of saying a container that doesn't have any sides, that doesn't have anything on the perimeter to basically guard all that is contained inside of it. That's what we would call a pan, right? A pan doesn't have anything that contains all the items inside of it. So that's exactly the case that the Gemara is describing. Mahu litein b'hapas l'tzarfon l'chala. The Gemara wants to know, if I have a whole bunch of breads or cookies or all those items that come together into a container, so to speak, like that, would they join together to be obligated in a hafrasha or not? That's the Gemara's question. And the Gemara says that this is an unresolved question. This is a question that is unsettled. We don't know what the answer to it is. And we're not exactly sure. I could say, well, they're all on the pan, so maybe they should be considered like they're in a container. But after all, they're not being contained. They're not really being contained because they can fall right off. There's nothing on the sides to really contain them. So this is a question that the Gemara poses, and the Gemara comes to the conclusion that we're not exactly sure what the answer is. So what do we do when we're not sure? What's the general guiding principle? When we're dealing with something which is a mitzvah d'araisa, we say you have to err on the side of caution. When we're dealing with something which is only a mitzvah midrabanan, we assume safek d'rabanan l'kula. You have a right to say, okay, it's only d'rabanan anyway. We don't have to worry about a case where we're not sure. And therefore, since nowadays challah is only midrabanan, and certainly in chutz la'aretz it's only midrabanan, therefore the Rambam teaches us that if a person has all those cookies getting together on a flat sheet pan, there would be no requirement of a hafrasha at all. Because again, they're not really contained in an item. That's exactly the question the Gemara has. Is that considered a container? Is that considered a basket? The Gemara comes to the conclusion that we're not really sure. And since we're not sure, we can say that nowadays challah is midrabanan, and therefore you have a right to say nothing to worry about. Okay, now let's move a little bit further. So we know you have to have a container that has some sort of depth and that has walls around it to guard it. Now the question is, does the basket only combine things that are hot when they come directly immediately out of the oven? Or can they be combined even later on? And this gets into our question about, last week we raised at the very end of the shiur, what about if a person has all the cookies or all the challahs in a freezer? So is the freezer able to combine everything? Well, so far so good. So far we have an item which has really a container, right? It has sides. It's not like a flat sheet pan. It has, what do you call that? It has depth, I guess. And it's able to hold everything. So maybe I should say the freezer is able to join everything together to obligate all that I baked in a hafrasha, which would be a major problem. Because very often, let's say we're getting ready for something that we know is coming up, my shalach manos. So I have every Sunday before Purim, I'm going to go and bake a few batches of cookies. I'm going to put them all in the freezer. Right? Someone? So that's what people do. You put them all in the freezer. Now that I've accumulated all these hundreds of cookies in the freezer, now it's going to turn out that I might be obligated in a hafrasha. So this is a very relevant question. Should we assume that a hafrasha would only be required if they're joined together while they are hot and immediately out of the oven? Or do we assume, no, even later on in the process, after they've cooled down, they should be obligated in a hafrasha as well? This is subject also to another discussion, but the Menchas Chinuch writes that absolutely the Shulchan Aruch assumes even if they are no longer hot, even if they've already cooled down, even if they're already cold, we assume that if they're later on joined together, they can be obligated in a hafrasha even then. So far, we're up to a problem with the freezer. Now, the next issue that we need to discuss is this only when they're actually touching one another? Again, when we spoke about the halacha of neshicha, of two raw batches of dough, we said the only time that it would require a hafrasha is if they actually join together to the point that you couldn't separate them easily. Now, that's obviously not the case by breads that are baked, right? Breads that are baked don't stick together that you can't take them apart. But the question is, do they only join together if they are actually touching? Or do you assume, no, anything that is contained inside of this box, anything that is contained inside of this basket, is already considered like they have joined together, even if they are not touching? This subject to yet another debate. So let's look in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch writes in number Vav. In Yoredeya, the Shulchan Aruch tells us, Shtei Isos, when you have two raw batches of dough, She'ein b'shum echad kashir, and you do not have in either one of them the required amount for a hafrasha. That's the example that we gave before, where I had the old mixers which did not hold more than 2.5 pounds of flour. So I make a recipe of 2.5 pounds. Now I make a second recipe of 2.5 pounds. I put them together. Im nogo ze baze ad shenidbakim ma'ad bazu ubazu mitstarfim. If they are going to be placed next to each other to the point that they're really stuck together, then they join together to be obligated in a hafrasha. That's the first halacha we discussed. Now the second halacha. Vim einam nidbakim. Let's say they are not stuck together, meaning they are already baked. Vehein b'sal echad, and now you put them into a basket. Hasal mitzarfa. So the basket is able to join them together. And the discussion breaks out, what exactly does the Shulchan Aruch mean? Is he talking about only where they're touching each other? Or is he talking about even when they're not touching each other? Let's say I have this huge matzah basket that we described before. I have 20 matzahs on this side and 20 on the other side. They're not touching each other at all, but they're all found in the same basket. This is subject to a major dispute in the Gedolei Aharonim. Should we assume that a situation like that would obligate a hafrasha, would require a hafrasha, even though the breads themselves are not touching? But since they're in the same basket, maybe they should join together to become obligated in a hafrasha. That's something to keep in mind. We're going to pull this all together when we talk about the freezer in 2 minutes. Another issue that is raised is, well, the only time they are joined together in a basket is if everything used the same kind of flour, if it's min bimino, if you used, which generally I would imagine most people use the same kind of flour for most recipes that they're making. Somebody told me last night, no, but you can make an oat recipe with this and a flour recipe with something else made of wheat. Okay, that can happen. But generally speaking, let's say you make all of your cookies with the same wheat flour. So we would assume that a hafrasha would be required if they join together in a basket. But what if they are using the same flour, but they are different flavors? So I have chocolate chip cookies, and I have muffins, and I have a whole bunch of different items that now join together in the basket. So this is also subject to a major dispute, whether or not that would be enough to require a hafrasha. Well, on the one hand, you'll say, I don't really want them mixed together. And the same way by neshicha, if you don't want them mixed together, they don't combine. Maybe the same should be over here. On the other hand, when you're talking about things that are just baked and just combined in a basket, it's very easy to separate them. It's not such a big deal. So maybe they should join together. So this is a major discussion once again. And this is something that is also very, very unclear. Should a hafrasha be required in a case like that? The final issue that we'll present before putting it all together is, what about in our contemporary society, where generally we bake something, and when you want to put it in the freezer, you don't just put it in the freezer the way it is, you put it in a Ziploc bag. So you have a bunch of different containers, basically, that are all put into one bigger container. So you have kli, besoch kli. You have the chocolate chip cookies are now in a big Ziploc, put it in the freezer. Now I have my challah in a big Ziploc bag, put it in the freezer. Now tomorrow I make something else, I put it in the freezer. But each one is in its own self-contained item. But now all of those containers go into one bigger container, which is the freezer. And the question is, should we assume that if you have a bunch of kelim ketanim that are then joined together into a one kli echad gadol, into one big container, should we assume that that requires a hafrasha or not? So basically, if you put all this together, you have a confluence of factors, and my father is of the opinion as follows. When it comes to a contemporary freezer, there is no obligation in a hafrasha for basically five primary reasons. Number one, we have five factors that we could put together as to why we might not be obligated in a hafrasha, and therefore we do not do it. Number one, which is, I hope, very relieving for many of us. So number one, but we're not done yet. Number one, factor number one, as we mentioned, there's a discussion whether or not the breads actually have to touch one another if they're in the basket. Is it good enough just that they're in one container, or do they actually have to touch one another to require a hafrasha? That's reason number one why we're not sure about the status of a freezer. Reason number two is because even if they don't have to touch one another, there's a major discussion if you have many different containers all put into one bigger container, is that considered being contained by one item? Or do we say, no, each one is looked at itself individually and they don't join together? That is factor number two as to why maybe the freezer does not require a hafrasha. Factor number three, there's a major discussion as to whether different items that taste different join together or not. Even if you don't need them to touch each other, and even if you say that each one that's in its own self-contained Ziploc bag will join together with other things, but because they're made of different flavors and of different recipes, maybe we should assume that those, once again, do not join together. That's factor number three. Factor number four is, maybe a freezer is so big, we don't consider that like a basket. That's considered like a house. Would anyone in their right mind say, if I have all these items in my house, well, we're all under one roof, we all have walls around us, maybe we should say the house is able to be like one big container. Nobody would say such a thing. Why? Because a house is a container. The house is a house. So maybe we should assume as well that a freezer, because it is so big in its volume and how much it can hold, maybe we should assume that is no longer what we would call a sal. We don't call that a halachic container. Because after all, it is like a house. It's just much bigger than a container, and that's not considered the requirement for a tzirif sal. And finally, there's an interesting suggestion that is made by some, and that is that since you have a freezer that needs to be plugged into the wall, maybe we should say it loses its status as a kli, as a utensil. Maybe since the only way that you can make use of this item is by having it attached to the house, maybe it really does become a part of the house. That's the question. And that has relevance to other issues as well. Take, for example, Tvilas Kelim. There's a question when you have an element that has to be plugged into the wall, does that require a tefillah in the mikvah or not? Now, I was always under the impression, mistakenly, that a as long as you put it in the mikveh and you let it dry out for 2-3 days or a week, everything is fine. I spoke to an electrical engineer who said, even if you let it dry for a month, it can still electrocute you somewhere along the process later on. So, not a good idea. Not a good idea. But the question is, do such items, do such elements require a tefilas kelim regardless of the danger? So I think the general assumption is no, that they do not. However, one of the factors that is mentioned is, maybe we should say, that it's no longer considered a kli, since you have to plug the toaster into the wall. Since the only way to have its function being used is by having it attached to the house, maybe it loses its status as a kli. So that's an interesting factor to consider. But be it as it may, I think we have enough reasons to assume why a freezer should not be a problem. We have basically a smattering of 5 different reasons to rely on that we would not require a hafrasha on a freezer. Yes? So you're asking, what about other items that are in the freezer that are not flour related? Should those be in the way? Yeah. So take, for example, let's say in my matzah box, I have not only matzahs, but I also have other items for Pesach. So I have my grape juice in there, and my wine, and my maror, and everything else. Should I assume that those would join together? I don't see a reason why not. I think that as long as you have the required amount of bread, or of cookies, or of dough together in the box, I think even though there might be other items involved, it doesn't take away from the fact that all these are now put together. But again, I think all these reasons that we mentioned is enough to assume. It's a good question, but I think it's enough to assume that a freezer we're pretty safe on. But now, here comes the problem. And this is a problem that we discovered last night in the shiur. See, it's a good thing we try it out on them last night. But the problem is a case that I never thought would come up. I mentioned this really backhanded last night, but somebody raised their hand and mentioned that it's actually a very relevant case. So again, you'll say it's very unusual that we'll have the freezer case that's really going to be obligated in hafresha, because nobody puts their items into the freezer, 100 challahs, uncovered. Nobody does such a thing. However, the Gemara does tell us that there is one further example of how we are able to be obligated in a hafresha, even though all the items were not kneaded together, and at the time of the kneading, there was not the required amount for a hafresha, and even though at the time that they were raw dough, we did not join them together. And even though they were not put into a basket all together, there is one other way in how they can be obligated in a hafrasha later on in the process. And that is, if you have something on a tray, and then you cover over all those items with a mappa. If you cover over everything with a tablecloth. Now, somebody mentioned to me last night that this is a very relevant case. How is it relevant? So this woman mentioned that it's relevant because, let's say, she said she's making a kiddush and she wants to go to shul, and she doesn't want to have a rush after she comes home from shul to set up the whole kiddush. So she goes and sets up the whole table, puts out all the trays of cookies before she goes out to shul, and then after everything's set up on her table, she takes a big tablecloth and drapes it over the table that the bugs shouldn't get there. That is exactly the case of Kisui Ayudei Mapa. I never would have thought of it, but she's correct. That is exactly the case that the Shulchan Aruch describes that would be obligated in a hafrasha. Now again, you would do a hafrasha probably without a bracha because it's subject to a major dispute. Number one, each one is on a different tray. That's the question. When you have different trays, do they join together? Number two, there are different flavors. They're not all the same. So maybe that's another question. But basically, I would say that in a case like that, my father agreed last night, that when you have a situation where you set up your whole table and all the cookies and pastries are out, and now you go ahead, and again, at the time that you bake them, none of them required a hafrasha. You had a little few cups of flour in each recipe. But now that you join the hundreds of cookies together on the table, and now you cover them all over with a mappa, with something that is going to cover everything at once, we assume in a case like that, a hafrasha would be required. So that is something to keep in mind. It's a very relevant case that this woman mentioned last night. Yeah. So that's a very good question. How would you do a hafrasha on Shabbos? The answer to that, if only we had another 10 weeks to talk about hafrasha schala, we would talk about all these issues, but we don't. So how do you do a hafrasha on Shabbos? The answer is you're not allowed to do a hafrasha schala on Shabbos. Now, forget about that case. What do I do in a case where I made my challah and Shabbos, I'm sitting down to the table and now I realize, oh, I can't believe it. I didn't do the hafrasha. I'm sure it happened once in a while, not to you, but to someone you know. So what do you do in a case like that? What do you do when you find out on Shabbos itself that you have not separated your hafrashas challah as you were supposed to? What do you do then? So that's a major, major issue. And the reason why it's an issue is because you cannot do a hafrasha on Shabbos. That's considered somewhat of a malacha midrabanan. So you're not allowed to do that. Yet, we assume that since chala in chutz la'aretz is only midrabanan, so we assume the halacha is ochel beholech ve'achar kach mafrish, which means you have a right to continue to eat as long as you separate a little bit. And from there, you'll separate on Matzah Shabbos. So you leave over the end of the chala, enough that you can separate from that a piece after Shabbos to burn it in the oven. But basically, you're able to do that. You can continue to eat as long as you leave a piece aside that you will do a hafrasha from that after Shabbos. That's the issue. The problem is going to be not the eating of the challah. The problem is your oven and your pans that you use to bake that challah that are now treif because challah wasn't separated. That's the problem. That's the problem. And if you have that shayla, we got to talk about it. That's a major issue. What do you do about doing a hafrasha on... I'm sorry, even if you do the hafrasha, now you're allowed to eat everything, but what do you do about the pans and the oven that you already used to bake your challahs in that did not have hafrasha taken from them? If you have that question, it's a very good question. So again, you should ask the question within 24 hours of when you did it, if possible, because that makes it a lot easier. If it's after 24 hours, you have some issues. So, I'm sorry, what? Okay. Same thing, correct. If you realize afterward that you have not done a hafrasha, if you realize afterward you haven't done a hafrasha, no problem. You can just take a cookie off and say, this is the hafrasha. It's no problem. Doesn't have to specifically be done beforehand. But the problem is, what if you forgot? And now you're later on in the process, so does your hafrasha go back on the blios that seeped into your pans or not? That's the basic question. That's a major question. Yes. How do you eat what?
I eat the challah.
So that's a good question. How do you eat that? So I don't think it's an issue because we assume it's a very insignificant amount of treif that went into your challah. But again, you're going to have to kosher those pans. If it comes up, we'll talk about it. But I assume after 6 weeks of shiur, no one will ever forget to do a hafrashas challah. Impossible. I think it's an impossibility. So that's something to keep in mind. That's something to keep in mind. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. If you double and triple a recipe, you obviously have to do a hafrasha if you now have the right amount. Okay. So now let's begin our review. We have a half an hour to do the review, yeah? No, that is a really good question. So listen carefully. Let's say you're saying you made 5 pounds of flour here. Now right away you make another 5 pounds of flour, but both of them are sitting on the counter. The halacha in a case like that is, somebody just called me this past week about it. They had 2 batches of dough. Each one required a hafrasha. They both happened to be sitting on the counter. And the question was, how many hafrashas should be done? Do you make 2 separate brachos and separate 2 different pieces? Or is it good enough just to do 1 because both of them are in front of you? And do you even have to mix them together? The Shulchan Aruch writes clearly in a case like that, 1 hafrasha is required on both. 1 hafrasha is required on both, even if they are not touching one another. Because since each one... What? You don't have to take from both. You can take 1 on both and that's good enough. 1 piece, 1 kezias would work for both of them. And there would be no requirement for you to make them touch each other at the time in order to obligate them in a hafrasha again, because each one was obligated on its own. And now you can say, this hafrasha works for both things that I baked, for both items that were baked here in front of me. Yeah.
Okay, so what if the person started and wanted to do it twice?
Okay, so again, if both of them are not in front of me, so then I... do 2 separate hafrashas. So two different things. Number one, if we're two different women and we don't want our challahs to be mixed together, I'm told that often they have a lot of women coming together to bake challahs or to knead challahs together, so each person has the right to make hafrasha on their own because I don't want mine getting mixed up with yours. I don't like your recipe. I like my own. But I don't want yours and you don't want mine. We want to have our own challahs. We don't want to mix everything up. And therefore, in a case like that, two separate hafrashas would be required. But if you're the person on your own and you're making both of them pretty much at the same time and both of them are on the counter at the same time, in a case like that, we would assume one hafrasha would be required with only reciting one bracha. Again, if you make them a day apart, you make them separately and you choose not to do them together, then obviously a separate bracha would be required. Yeah.
Okay, so just one bracha?
One piece, yeah. Nope. Okay. Okay. Any other questions before we review? Yes. So again, your question is, let's say you have the Kiddush case where you cover them all over with the tablecloth and now you're obligated to do a hafrasha. So you set aside the cookie and you would burn that. You would burn that, as far as I understand. Yeah, that would be the same. It's a hafrasha schala, the same way you would always do a hafrasha schala. Okay, so now let's begin our review. Last night, unfortunately, my review went 20 or 25 minutes overtime, so anyone who has to leave, hopefully we'll try to do it in better timing today, but anyone who has to leave, please don't be uncomfortable to leave. So we started our series on Hafrashas Challah. Turn to the other side of the page. Hope people can read this. But here is basically a summary of everything we have discussed over the last 6 weeks. Actually, it's 7 weeks now. So here is everything we've discussed over the last 7 weeks. Let's begin as follows. We talked about Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is the Adon HaNaviim. He is the greatest leader that ever lived. He's the greatest Navi that we ever had. And yet Moshe Rabbeinu considers himself to be somewhat lacking. The Gemara says that there's going to be a Suda Liyasadava, there's going to be a party, God's grand banquet that he's going to put together for all the righteous people over all the generations. Then they're going to come benching and everyone's going to say, well, who should we honor with the benching? Who should be the one to bench with the cup of wine? So they turn to David HaMelech and he says, why are you coming to me? There are much greater people than I. You go to Shlomo and they go to this one and that one and Aaron, and finally they say, oh, Moshe Rabbeinu, what about you? Moshe Rabbeinu says, no, I am lacking. Why am I lacking? Because I never got to go into Eretz Yisrael. So Moshe Rabbeinu himself, who reached the pinnacle of a Jewish existence, felt that he was lacking because he never had the opportunity to go into Eretz Yisrael. An unbelievable statement that Moshe Rabbeinu himself says, and this is something that is a very important idea to keep in mind, certainly after Tisha B'Av. Going into Eretz Yisrael is such an incredible gift that we all have, that we can go as often as we want, as often as we please. It's something Moshe Rabbeinu offers in our parsha, 515 tefillos. All he wants in his life is to be able to go in, and he has not granted his request, and we take it for granted, and we go to Eretz Yisrael, we just run around and visit the beaches and do whatever we do. What about the fact that this is what Moshe Rabbeinu looked forward to his entire life? This is what he wanted. And then the Gemara asks us, why did Moshe Rabbeinu want to go? Because he heard there was a good spa in Tveria? He wanted to go because he heard there was a good beach in Eilat? What did he want to go for? V'chilecho mipiria? He heard there was good food there, some good shawarma? Why does Moshe Rabbeinu want to go into Eretz Yisrael? Says the Gemara, Moshe Rabbeinu tells us the reason why he wants to go in is because there are a whole category of mitzvahs that can only be performed in Eretz Yisrael, and I want to have the opportunity to perform them. And what you see from this Gemara is that the whole greatness of having a land, of having Eretz Yisrael, is to perform the mitzvahs that we can do in the land itself. To have a land without doing mitzvahs in it is meaningless. That's just having a country like having any other country. There's no meaning, there's no significance to Eretz Yisrael without the mitzvahs that are supposed to be performed there being done. Contrary to many people's belief, but this is a major mistake. Eretz Yisrael has no significance if we don't perform the mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz. This is what Moshe Rabbeinu wants only because he wants to be able to perform the mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael. And this is why we decided that even though unfortunately we in Chutz La'aretz do not have the opportunity to perform the mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz, the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Kook and many others write that those living in Chutz La'aretz at least have to prepare themselves, at least have to familiarize themselves with the halachos that are pertaining to the laws of living in Eretz Yisrael. And one of those is the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. That's why we decided to talk about the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah this summer, to give ourselves a little bit of a perspective of what it would be like to live in Eretz Yisrael. So we mentioned The Gemara has in Kiddushin that we have two categories of mitzvahs. The Gemara is in Kiddushin, Daf Lamed Vav, that we have some mitzvahs that are called mitzvahs hatluyas ba'aretz that can only be performed in the land of Israel, and we have other mitzvahs that are to be performed everywhere. So for example, Shabbos, Shofar, Lulav, Tzitzis, Tfilin, Shabbos candles, all these different things are not connected at all to Eretz Yisrael. Those are mitzvahs that we're obligated to perform wherever we might be. On the other hand, we have a list of mitzvahs that can only be performed in the land itself. For example, Shemitah, Yovel, Trumas, Maestros, Bikurim, Challah, all these different mitzvahs we assume are only to be performed in Eretz Yisrael, which means that since this is one of the mitzvahs that is in that list, Hafrashas Challah is in that list, therefore we would assume that Hafrashas Challah really is a mitzvah that only applies in Eretz Yisrael proper. We'll see in a couple of minutes why we took it over and brought it to a replicated mitzvah in Chutz La'aretz as well. The Gemara says in Kiddushin as well that even though the Jewish people were traveling 40 years in the desert, finally reached Eretz Yisrael, we do not assume that immediately upon entry into Eretz Yisrael that the requirement of all these mitzvahs began. There was a 14-year buffer zone, a 14-year period when they were in the middle of dividing and conquering the land. In those 14 years, the mitzvahs hatluyas ba'aretz did not apply. Their obligation only started after the 14 years. However, the one exception to the rule, there are a few exceptions, but the one major notable exception to the rule was the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. Again, the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah started immediately upon entering the land. Immediately when they came into the land, and they did not wait that 14-year period before going into the land, before conquering and dividing the land, in order to be obligated in the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. We then spoke about the discussion that the Achronim have. Reb Yonasan Ivishitz in the 1700s spoke about the fact that maybe there's some significance, maybe there's some meaning to a person trying to obligate themselves in the mitzvahs hatluyas ba'aretz, even if they live in Chutz La'aretz. So, is there any reason for me, this Shemitah, to go ahead and buy a little piece of land that I should also be considered like some sort of quasi-farmer, that I should be able to perform the mitzvah of Shemitah, or do you assume no? If you live in Chutz La'aretz, you are not part of the mitzvah at all. And furthermore, if I'm living in Chutz La'aretz and I cannot perform the mitzvah on my own, am I even able to set somebody else in my place to do the mitzvah that I myself cannot perform? The Mishnah says in Maseches Nazir, Kol milsa de'iu lamatzi avid, shliach lamatzi mashvi. Anything that I myself cannot perform, I cannot have a shaliach do in my stead either. So the example that the Achronim give, the Dov Mervav, the Noda Behuda, talk about the following case. What if you have a father who has his firstborn child, Hidden Aben is required, yet the father is going on a business trip. He's not going to be here when the Yom Lamed Aleph, when the 31st day comes around. He's not going to be able to perform the Pidyon HaBen. So he has a trusted neighbor who he likes very much. He goes to him and he says, here is the money for the Pidyon HaBen. I want to send you as my shaliach to perform the Pidyon HaBen on my behalf. And the Achronim discuss, is he even able to set up a shaliach for himself? After all, if he would want to do the Pidyon HaBen today, he would not be able to do the Pidyon HaBen because it's before the 30-day period. His son is not even at the right age yet. So this is a major discussion as well when it comes to the mitzvahs hatluyas ba'aretz. For those of us living in Chutz La'aretz, is there any meaning, is there any significance to us contributing and becoming a part, so to speak, in the mitzvahs hatluyas ba'aretz when we ourselves do not really have the ability to perform those mitzvahs on our own because we are not there? That was a major discussion. There are those who argue that it would work. There are those who argue that it certainly would not work. Rav Asher Weiss is very strong in his opinion that he feels we're missing the boat of what Shemitah is all about. You think just because you write a small check and you buy a small piece of land in Eretz Yisrael and you don't have any sacrifice that's involved in what you're doing, you think you really have a performance of the mitzvah. That's not what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. Rachmana Liba Boy, what God really wants from all of us is our heart, is our sacrifice, is to show Him how committed we are to perform His mitzvahs, and just to write a check and say, oh, now we took care of the mitzvah of Shemitah, would not really be fulfilling our obligation. We then moved on to discuss that challah seems to be somewhat of an aberration. Challah seems to be, in many ways, an anomaly. Number one, because if you see over here, the bullets that are a little more indented, thank you. Number one, although when it comes to Trumas and Maestros, we assume that you have an obligation to separate upon the completion of any given item that is grown. So you have olives that grow, you do the hafrasha after you harvest them. You have grapes that grow, you do the hafrasha after you harvest them. You have wheat that grows, you go ahead and you do the hafrasha, shumas, and maestros after you harvest them. There is no other item that we find that later on in the process you're going to be obligated in yet another hafrasha. We don't say that once you make those grapes into grape juice or into wine, we do not assume that now you have to go ahead and do a hafrasha once again. We do not assume that now you make the olives into oil that you have to do a hafrasha again. The wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt are the only ones that require a double hafrasha. Number one, when you harvest them. And number two, when you go ahead and make them into the final product, when you make them into batter. And the question is, why? Question number two is, why is this something, as opposed to the other mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz, that only applied after the 14-year period was over, after they divided and conquered the land, why is it that this mitzvah of hafrashas challah began immediately upon entry into the land itself? Number three, why is it that hafrashas challah is put, juxtaposed, right next to this parsha that talks about avodah zarah? Why is avodah zarah connected at all to the mitzvah of hafrashas challah? Number four, why is it that the Medrash says in Parshas Bereishis, Bereishis bara Elokim b'shvil Reishis, the reason why the world was created, it was worthy for the world to be created, just because there would come a time when we would perform the mitzvah of hafrashas challah? Really? If you had to check what were the most important reasons why the world would be created, I assume nobody would have put hafrashas challah on the list. I would have put other things on the list, but hafrashas challah would not have made it to my list. So why is hafrashas challah considered to be such a central, such an essential part of our religion? Number five, why is it that the Navi Yechezkel teaches us, La'niach bracha al beisecha, a person who goes ahead and does the hafrashas challah will have blessing in their home? What is so unique, what is so special, what is so central about hafrashas challah that we are given the blessing of having bracha in our house if we do it properly? What is so different about hafrashas challah above and beyond other mitzvahs? And here we discussed the insight, the idea of the Talmud Rebbe, where he suggested that very often in life we get involved in certain things and certain activities, and the hand of God is very obvious to us. For example, you have a farmer who's beginning to do the stages of planting, and he's fertilizing, and he's planting, and he's investing, and he's putting so much time and effort into everything that he wants to come out of this land, but he knows that he's totally dependent on the hand of God, and if God is not going to provide him with the rain, all of his work is for naught, and everything that he tried so hard to accomplish is going to be in vain. And therefore, the Talmud Rebbe writes that a farmer knows, Hazorim Bedima, he knows that when he's going ahead and trying to bring about his crops, he knows that it's a very difficult, it's an arduous process. He knows that it's not so easy, and he knows that he's totally dependent in the hand of God. But what happens later? What happens after God sends him the rain, and all of a sudden the wheat grows and the barley grows, and now I'm the wealthy man who is harvesting all this great produce? All of a sudden, God's no longer in the picture. All of a sudden, it's all me. I'm the one who harvested. I'm the one who goes ahead and makes it into flour. I'm the one who goes ahead and makes it into bread. I don't need God anymore. And God wants us to remember at that point in the process as well, don't forget about me. Don't forget it's only because I made sure that this is going to be successful. That is the only reason why you are prosperous. That is the only reason why you're able to have bread. That's the only reason you can sustain yourself. It is not kochi v'otzim yadi. It is not you yourself. It is me, God says, who does everything. And this is why we remind ourselves, specifically with the challah, specifically by something which is such a staple of civilization. It is such an important part of life. Bread is something we cannot live without. Al alechem levado yichya ha'adam. We live on bread alone, the pasuk says. And therefore we assume that this is why challah is singled out as opposed to many other areas of produce, that we assume that you have to once again do a hafrasha, even though you already did a hafrasha at the time of the harvesting. We spoke more about that, but now is not the time to elaborate. We then got into a discussion about the mitzvah of challah nowadays. Is it considered a biblical obligation, or is it considered only a rabbinic obligation? So the Rambam reminds us that the only time you have an obligation to do a hafrasha challah is when you follow two criteria. Number one, if you're in Eretz Yisrael, that is the only time you have an obligation to do a hafrasha challah on a biblical level. Number two, says the Rambam, even if you're living in Eretz Yisrael and you're doing everything right and you're the farmer and you're harvesting and you're making it into wheat and now you're making that into dough, we assume you're only obligated to do a hafrasha when we have bias kulchem, when we have most of the Jewish people at the time living in Eretz Yisrael. But if you don't have most of the Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael, for example, us nowadays, so we assume that hafrashas challah, even in Eretz Yisrael, is only midrabanan. That's the general assumption. So nowadays, since it's only midrabanan, what difference would that make? Why should we differentiate? Why should we distinguish between a mitzvah derabanan or a mitzvah deraisa? Does anybody say that just because lighting Hanukkah candles is midrabanan, therefore we don't take it seriously? We take it very seriously. Do we say that just because Mikra Megillah is only midrabanan, therefore we shouldn't do it? Of course we do it. The rabbis told us to do it, so we do it. So what difference does it make whether Hafrashas Challah is a biblical obligation or only a rabbinic obligation? And the answer to that is that the general rule is when you have a suffix, when you're not sure about something on a level of Doraisa, we say you have to err on the side of caution. But when you have a suffix by an issue which is only Midrabanan, we say that you can rely on the fact that maybe you did it and you don't have to go ahead and do it again. So over here, really, we should have said that since Challah nowadays is only Midrabanan, therefore we should say that if a suffix arises, if a person is unsure whether or not they did a Hafrasha, we really should have said that a Hafrasha is not required because Suffik Midrabanan Lekula. Whenever we're talking about a Suffik Midrabanan, we have a right to say we probably did it and there's no reason to go back and do it again. However, we suggested that this is incorrect for two reasons. It's incorrect. Reason number one is because the Mishneh Berurah writes from the Pri Megadim. Let's say you have a person on Sukkis who finds themselves in the time of Bein Hashmashos, which is twilight zone. You're not sure if it's daytime, you're not sure if it's nighttime, and you're not sure whether or not you shook lulav today. So here I am, and I'm having a suffik whether or not I shook lulav today. So the Mishneh Berurah writes, even though suffik derabanan lekula, even though we know that shaking the dalad minim is only midrabanan most of the days of Sukkis, still we assume that since it's so easy for me to do it, since it will just take 30 seconds for me to pick up the lulav, shake the lulav the way I'm supposed to, it's so simple to do that, we don't rely on the principle of suffik derabanan lekula. And the same would apply in other areas as well, and therefore Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, by Hafrashas Challah, the same should be the case. Since it's so easy for us to perform our obligation of Hafrasha, and it doesn't cost us anything, it's so simple just to separate a little piece, therefore, even though Challah is only Midrabanan, there is no reason why not to go ahead and do it, and we should not rely on the principle of Safek Derabanan Lekula. We then got into a discussion as well. We have a right to assume that every time somebody is used to doing something in a certain order, in a certain process, should we assume that they innately do all the steps of that process, or should we assume that no, maybe not? So that's the question over here. Should we assume that just because the woman already baked the challah in the oven, that probably means that she already did the hafrasha, because that's what she's always used to doing? Now, I don't know about you, but nowadays I know that myself, we're always pulled in a million different directions. We get a phone call, and we have an email, and we have a text message, and we have a million things going on at the same time, with the kids are screaming, and something else is in the oven. We have so many things on our minds at once. It's not the way it used to be. Now, my father was once talking to me about Hilchos Nida, so he said, they used to talk about a hargasha, that a woman used to wait around for a hargasha in order to know when Hilchos Nida, really the onset of the Nida process was. My father said it used to be that women just sat around all day. That's what they did. And therefore, there was an explanation of exactly when the process began because they weren't so busy. There weren't a million things going on. They really did not go out to work. The husbands are the ones who worked the fields. The women sat at home. Wasn't much going on. And that's why we have descriptions of when a hargasha began because the women knew exactly how their bodies worked. Nowadays, when we're pulled in a million different directions and everyone's running and doing so many things, we're not as focused as we used to be. It's not a bad thing. It's just that society has changed. And therefore, the circumstances change as well. So too over here, I'm not sure that we can always rely on the fact that, oh, this is what we always do, to be mafrish challah, and therefore we probably did it now as well. I don't know. Not sure we can rely on probabilities nowadays because we have ourselves torn in so many different directions. We then discuss whether or not Hafrashas Challah is considered a mitzvah or a matir, which means, is Hafrashas Challah a obligation, just like the obligation to shake lulav, the obligation to light the candles on Hanukkah, like the obligation to blow shofar, so do we have an obligation to be mafrish challah? Or do we assume that no, Hafrashas Challah is merely a matir, which means it is just a permit, it's a license for me. If I want to go ahead and eat this dough, and eat the batter, and eat the bread later, I have to be mafrish challah. But if I have no intention on eating it, for example, I made a batch of dough and I just realized by mistake I threw in some vinegar that wasn't supposed to be there. So I know it's going to taste awful. I'm going to dispose of it. I'm going to throw it in the garbage and start all over. Do I have to be mafrish challah now, even though I have no intention on eating it? Do I have to do that or not? This is the major question. Is hafrashas challah a mitzvah? And if it's a mitzvah, then you have to do it regardless of whether or not you plan to eat it. Or is it simply a matir, and therefore it would only be an obligation if you plan to go ahead and eat it. But if you don't want to eat it, you don't have to do it. And then we discussed how that plays into many other mitzvahs as well. For example, chalitza. You have a woman who's 99 years old, loses her husband, unfortunately, and now they had no children. She has to perform yibum or chalitza. So let's say she has to perform chalitza, but she has no intention on getting remarried. Does she have an obligation to go and perform the mitzvah of chalitza, even though she has no intent on getting remarried? Or say no, chalitza is only something that will give her a permit, a license to get remarried, but if she has no intention on doing so, there is no mitzvah of chalitza at all. And this is something that comes up by tfilas kelim also. Let's say I bought something, I have no intention on using it right now. Do I have to do the tfilas kelim? Even if I put a big sign on it that says, don't use until you tovel, am I allowed to leave it around my house or not? And by Erev Tavshilin, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach speaks about whether Erev Tavshilin is considered something that is a mitzvah or a matir. So for example, I go to a hotel for Pesach, I have no intent on baking or cooking anything over Shabbos, over Yom Tov for Shabbos, because the hotel is going to do everything for me. Is there a requirement to make an Erev Tavshilin in a case like that? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach argues that no, an Erev Tavshilin in such a case should be made without a bracha, because Erev Tavshilin is not really a mitzvah, it is merely a matir. And because of that, the Magen Avraham writes, since Hafrashas Challah is only a mitzvah, is only a matir, it's only to give me the license to eat the bread, but it's not really a mitzvah per se. That is why the Magen Avraham argues that a woman is allowed to be mafresh the challah while sitting down. Even though generally we assume that brachas are supposed to be recited in an erect position, when I make a bracha on the shofar, when I make a bracha on the lulav, whenever I perform a mitzvah, I'm supposed to stand up while reciting the bracha. Magen Avraham writes over here, quoting a Gemara, that since this is only a matir, since this is only a quasi-mitzvah, it's not a real mitzvah like any other, it's just a mitzvah that allowed me to eat my bread, I'm allowed to perform that bracha even while sitting down. I don't have to particularly stand up. Now, somebody told me last night that women are always standing anyway while they're kneading and making the challah, so it might not be so relevant, but it could be relevant. It could be relevant if you happen to be sitting down, so you don't have to stand up. Am I going too fast? No, it's okay? Are we skipping anything on here? Any questions so far? Either it means nobody knows what I'm talking about, or it means that we're doing a good job. Okay. What? When's the Bechina? It's on the table here. The Bechina will be if this year nobody calls with any questions on Hafrashas Challah, because nobody made a mistake. We'll see. That's the Bechina. And I have a feeling that somebody will. But it probably won't be anyone who is here. So, we then spoke about the fact that the Rambam tells us that Hafrashas Challah is only midirabbanan nowadays in Chutz La'aretz, and even in Eretz Yisrael it's probably only midirabbanan. The question is, why is it that we have made an imitation mitzvah? Why is it that we have reinstituted this mitzvah and made some sort of simulation that reflects the original mitzvah of Hafrash in Eretz Yisrael? We don't always find that that is something that we do. We don't always make imitation mitzvahs. For example, the Gemara says in Maseches Sukkah that if you have a shortage of esrogim one given year, and you have no way of getting any esrogim to your community, maybe, says the Gemara, maybe you should take a lemon. This way your family won't forget about the fact that you're supposed to have a yellow item that comes along with the Dalet Minim on Sukkis. Says the Gemara, bad idea. Why? Because we're afraid maybe it will lead to a major mistake, because your grandchildren 20 years down the line are going to say, I remember when Zaidi took a lemon. They're not going to remember that the reason why Zaidi or Bubby took a lemon is because, oh, that year there happened to be an emergency and there was a shortage and there was nothing available. All they're going to remember is that that is good enough. So we do not make an imitation mitzvah in a case like that. Similarly, the Prima Gadim has a shaila about a person on Hanukkah who lives in a community where there's a shortage of oil. And all I was able to get together was a small amount of oil. Should I go ahead and use that small amount even though it will only burn for 5 minutes, which is not the required amount of the 30 minutes that you need? Is there any significance to doing that? Should we make some sort of imitation mitzvah of Hadlakas Neiros Chanukah? Or do you say no? If you cannot perform the mitzvah properly, don't do it at all. That's the suffix of the Prima Gadim. And again, this comes up in many different areas. Do we have the right to institute imitation mitzvahs? Or do we say no? If you cannot perform the mitzvah, then you cannot perform the mitzvah. Don't try to make new ways of doing it in times when you're not able to do so. You should just do it when you're able to. When you're not able to, forget about it. So that's the question. But over here, for whatever reason, Hafrashas Challah seems to be an exception to the rule. Hafrashas Challah seems to be something that we do make an imitation mitzvah, and we perform it even in Chutz La'aretz, because the Rishonim say, because Kedei Shelo Tishtakech Toras Challah Miyisrael. We don't want people to forget. Imagine we're going to go thousands of years in exile. Thousands of years, nobody's going to be doing the mitzvah Hafrashas Challah. That would be a terrible thing. And the Gemara says, therefore, Kedei Shelo Tishtakech Toras Challah Miyisrael. We make sure to have an imitation mitzvah of Challah, an opportunity to perform it, even as we sit in Chutz La'aretz here, and we do our mitzvah in not the profound and not the proper way. So what exactly is the real mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah? Well, the real mitzvah is, says the Gemara, that you should take a piece of challah and not burn it in the oven. The piece of challah is supposed to be taken and given to the Kohen. You're supposed to take the challah and give it to the Kohen. The Kohen is supposed to eat it. The Kohen recites a bracha of Hamotzi Lechem in Haaretz, and a bracha of Asher Kedushanim in Mitzvosa V'tzivanu Lechol B'truma. The Kohen actually recites a bracha on it. Bizman Hazeh, living in Chutz La'aretz, where all the Kohanim are Tamei, and we don't have anyone who is fit to eat the Truma, we assume that you should burn it in the place of giving it to the Kohen. Why do we burn it? Because the Gemara says in Psachim that when you have Truma or Kachim that becomes Tamei, that becomes impure, we go ahead and we burn it instead of just leaving it around. So that is why our mitzvah is to go and burn the Hafreshas Chala nowadays. Now the question is, we have two different kinds of categories of Tuma. We have one kind of person who is Tamei, who is what we call a Tuma Hayotze Ala Megufo, which means it is inherent, it's a intrinsic kind of Tuma that the Gemara describes, which means this Tuma comes from some sort of emission from the person's body, some sort of discharge, a Nida, a Zaba, somebody who has something that comes out of their body, a man or a woman. So something of that nature is considered the real, bona fide, serious level of Tuma. Then we have a secondary level of Tuma, which is a Tuma that is more extrinsic, a Tuma that comes from an acquired Tuma, meaning I attend a Levaya, I come in contact with somebody who attended a Levaya, I'm in the same room as a dead body, something of that nature, where if I am the dead body, I also would be considered a serious Tuma, but that I guess is not so relevant. So anyway, in a case like this, the question is, when we have Chala in Chutz La'aretz, when we have the mitzvah of Hafrashas Chala in Chutz La'aretz, which is not really biblical, it is only a rabbinic obligation, should we assume that both categories of Tuma apply, and a Kohen who either became Tamei because of an intrinsic Tuma, or a Kohen who became Tamei because of an outside factor, both of them are not allowed to eat the Truma? The answer to that is no. Since we're dealing with Hafrashas Chala, which is only Midirabanan in Chutz La'aretz, we assume that only the first category of Tuma applies. Only somebody who's Tamei from a Tuma Hayotze Ala Megufo is forbidden from eating this challah. However, if you have somebody who is only the second level of Tuma, meaning you have somebody who just comes in contact with a dead body, they would be allowed to go ahead and eat the Tuma or challah nowadays. So the question is, why don't we find a 7-year-old girl or a 7-year-old boy who certainly has not had any discharge from their body yet, because they cannot have any discharge from the body yet, they're not old enough, why don't we assume that you should go and give the hafrasha to them nowadays? Why not let them enjoy all the hafrashas from all of our challahs that we make? And the answer to that is very simple. Number one, because they are all suffic kohanim nowadays, we really don't have a clear list of who is a kohen and who is not. And number two, because we know little children very often share their snacks, right? My son has a peanut allergy when he goes to camp. I don't know that his friends are not going to share with him their bambas and all their snacks. It happens. It happens. Kids share their snacks, and the same will be over here. We're concerned. Maybe this young little Kohen will innocently share his snack with somebody else. Yes, he's a nice kid, but he's doing the wrong thing. He's not allowed to give his snack to a Yisrael who is a non-Kohen, and therefore, we have a concern about that happening. Be it as it may, we assume that a person should not leave the Hafrasha around. Terrible things can come about from leaving the Hafrasha around. We mentioned that there is a minig that some people have, which is a terrible minig, to leave the Hafrasha around till Erev Pesach and then burn it. That is something that should not be followed. That is a terrible minig. The Matzah Ephraim talks about it, that it's really not a good idea. I mentioned that I had a personal story where somebody made a big mistake, left it in the freezer, and then was stuck with a big issue before Pesach. Not a good idea. You should not leave the Hafrasha around. Try and burn it right away. We then mentioned that the Hafrasha should be burned in the oven before you make everything else. Before you bake all the rest of the challahs, you should bake it in the oven. It should not be baked simultaneously with other things in the oven, because L'chatchila, the Rama says, that we feel that we are of the opinion that reicha milsa, the aroma from something, even if it has no steam, even if there's nothing coming out of it, but just the aroma itself is something that you have to be careful from. And therefore, if you're baking the challah in the oven, which is treif, together with the or challahs that you plan to eat for Shabbos, that is something that lechatchila should not be done. Again, if you did it, b'di'evet, you're allowed to eat it, but lechatchila, it is something that we should try and avoid. We then spoke about, top of the second column, we then spoke about the requirement necessary for a proper batter, a halachic batter, and that is only if something is made of the 5 grains, wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. Those are the only 5 things that require a hafrasha if you use them in your dough. Meaning, if the flour is made from rice, or if the flour is made from flaxseed, we would assume that no hafrasha would be required, even though we assume that they taste like bread, and they feel like bread, and they look like bread, but a hamotzi lechem in haaretz will not be recited, and a tilas yadayim will not be required, And a hafrashas challah would not be required either, because in order to be considered halachic bread, it has to be something that is made from the chameshes mini dagan, from wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. I just want to finish in order that people can be able to go. That is with regard to those five. Then we discussed, what about if you have wheat, barley, oats, rye, or spelt that are made not naturally from the ground, but they're growing in something like hydroponics? Is that really considered like wheat, barley, oats, rye, spelt, or is that considered something totally different? So that is a major suffix in the Achronim. That is a major question. And I guess if you have flour like that, you have to ask a very serious shaila. It's not really clear what the story of that is. We then moved on to the discussion, what about if I have something which is not water-based? What if I have a mixture of dough that is grape juice-based or apple juice-based or something of that nature? Would that also require a hafrasha or not? So that is also subject to a debate in the Rishonim, and therefore the Shach suggests that when you have something that is not water-based, that you have something that is apple juice or grape juice or egg-based or something of that nature, we assume that a hafrasha should be done without reciting a bracha. The suggestion is given that you should always just put a little bit of water in order that you can be obligated in a hafrasha schala. So my father told me once that he always thought that a lot of water would be required, because basically you would have to put enough water in that you would be able to mix the whole batter and have it stick together without anything else. So that, I would have imagined, is a lot of water. But my father told me that he went to a matzah bakery and he learned that really it's much less than we would have thought. Because in the matzah bakery they use a very minimal amount of water. They don't want it to become chametz. And he said because they knead it so heavily and because they work on it so hard and they're so aggressive with it, therefore even a little bit of water is able to make the dough into one mixture. So my father said, you'll be surprised. Again, the Shach writes over here that when you have a mixture of dough that uses something other than water, you make a bracha, you should recite, you should do the hafrasha without reciting a bracha. But the suggestion is always try to put a little bit of water in, that you should obligate yourself in a hafrasha. How much water is that? Probably not so much. Again, because even with a little bit of water, if you aggressively need it, it will be able to become into something that requires a hafrasha. We then spoke about the different kinds of batters. We have, again, you look at the sheet, we have the thick and yeasty dough which is baked. In a case like that, everyone would agree that a hafrasha would be required. We then spoke about the thick, pasty, or yeasty dough that is cooked. For example, the zeppeli that somebody mentioned, something of that nature that is fried or cooked. So something like that, that you do not bake in the oven, is subject to a major machlokes, whether or not that requires a hafrasha. And therefore we say it requires a hafrasha without a bracha. We then spoke about something which is a little more of a liquidy batter, a viscous batter. In a case like that, we assume that if it's baked, also that is subject to a major machlokas, and therefore we assume that a hafrasha should be done without reciting a bracha. And then finally we spoke about when you have a viscous batter that is cooked, that is fried, meaning you have two strikes against you. Number one, it's not a thick batter, and number two, it is not baked in the oven, it is rather cooked. In a case like that, no hafrasha would be required at all. We then mentioned the last case, which is when you have something which is a overly viscous batter, something which can be poured directly out of the mixing bowl, and it will take the form of the pan that you're putting it into. In a case like that, it is also a major machlokas. Should we assume that even though you're baking it, still, since it's so watery, since it's so syrupy, we should assume that a hafrasha is not required or not, and therefore the halacha is that you do a hafrasha on something like that without reciting a bracha. We then spoke about Torah measurements that are in general very unclear. We don't know exactly how to measure precisely Torah measurements, and that's why there is a major dispute as to whether or not we have the proper measurements. Do we really know how to measure properly what the Torah meant for us to have in many of the different instances in mitzvahs where a certain volume is required? We spoke about the story of the Noda Yehuda in the 1700s who did a experiment, and the Noda Yehuda said that everybody up until now has had the wrong measurements. I think it's bigger. We said the story about his student, his Talmud, who said that he made a mistake. And he said, my Rebbe is a giant, my Rebbe is a great towering figure, and therefore he has it all wrong. And the question was, how exactly to interpret the laugh, the jest of the Noda Yehuda? Did he mean to retract from his statement, or did he just mean to blow off his student who was just being annoying? So that was the question. And Rav Henkin basically laid down the rules in our contemporary understandings and measurements as saying the following. If you have less than 3 pounds of flour that you're using, no hafrasha is required at all. If you have between 3 and 5 pounds of flour, then a hafrasha should be done without a bracha, because again, we're not sure, that's the middle ground. And if you have something that is 5 pounds or more, then a hafrasha should be done with a bracha. We then mentioned the importance of not trying to get ourselves out of the obligation of hafrashas challah. So again, if the recipe only calls for 2 pounds of flour, then that's what you do. But if the recipe calls for a lot more, but you just don't want to get involved in the issue because After all, it's not a water-based mixture, and it's hydroponic flour, and you have all the questions coming together, and you don't know exactly what to do, and you don't want to get involved in the shayla, and you're not interested in calling the rabbi. So in a case like that, maybe you'll just make it a smaller batter. Says the Shulchan Aruch, you are not allowed to do so, because you are trying just to get yourself out of the performance of a mitzvah. And we learn from Moshe Rabbeinu that one should always try and go out of their way to become obligated in any given mitzvah. And then we got to today's shir, one last point that we spoke about last week was, should a Shechiyana be recited the first time we perform a mitzvah? The general opinion that we follow is, even though the Rama says that you should, we're not going to get back into the whole discussion, but generally we assume, like the Shach, that a Shechiyana should not be recited the first time we perform a mitzvah, which means first time a woman goes to the mikveh, the first time we light Shabbos candles, first time we do Afrashas Challah, the first time we do Pidyon HaBen, the first time we do all kinds of things, we do not recite a Shechiyana on that occasion. And finally, we got to today's shir, which was, although we have a requirement of 3 to 5 pounds doing a hafrasha without a bracha, 5 pounds or more doing a hafrasha with a bracha, are there instances where you can be obligated in a hafrasha even later on in the process? And we mentioned 3 scenarios. One is if you have neshicha, one is if you have the dough touching each other to the point where they won't be able to be separated without one piece being connected to the other. That's the first time you can have it. The second example we gave is when you have tziruf sal, the case of the matzahs all being connected in a big container, and now you've accumulated more than the size of a hafrasha. So in a case like that, we assume also, even though at the time of the kneading you did not have the required amount, but since later on in the process they're all joined together in one big container, therefore we assume a hafrasha is required. And we got into all the questions with regard to that. What about when they're not touching each other? What about when they're not hot, straight out of the oven? What about when each one is in a separate container and now all those smaller containers are put into a larger container? And what about a freezer, which is considered like a house itself? A freezer is so big, it's not really considered like an item. It's not considered like a container. Maybe we should say that a hafrasha is not necessary. We then discussed the last issue, which was, what about kisui ayidei mapa? Meaning, I have my kiddush, I set everything up before I go to shul, I have all the cakes and cookies, and now I cover them over with one big tablecloth, and I have everything spread out on the table. Again, in a case like that, we would assume that a hafrasha schala should be done without reciting a bracha, because again, they join together. However, they are all on different platters. Each one is on their own kli, each one is separate, and therefore it's a major point of debate whether or not a hafrasha should be done. So I would say that a hafrasha schala should be done in a case like that without reciting a bracha. Once again, thank you everybody for coming and for joining us and for making the summer so special. If anyone has any